So, first of all, I want to thank Mary Cam for inviting me to do this. And Matt, it's just been a blast to have these preparation sessions in which we've been going at it. It's been a lot of fun. It's great. It feels like it's nice to be back to my old colleagues, but since having gone over to the dark side, and since coming here, there's a risk of telling you that the things that you've been doing for 100 years have been wrong and it's time to move on, I'm a little intimidated, particularly going up against someone like Matt. I realize that there's no way that I'm going to win on data. So we used to joke back in STD and HIV prevention that the shop over there in Jim Curran's shop was the data-free zone. But I realize that the only way that I'm going to win today is if I go over to the data-free zone. So bear with me a little bit. In addition to working as a chief medical officer in New England, for the last year I've had the privilege of being on detail to the CMS Innovation Center. Where we've been doing an awful lot of work to try to implement some of the really exciting aspects of the Affordable Care Act relating to truly integrating population health into clinical care. When I have been in Washington, though, it's been really interesting. Maybe you haven't seen a lot of the news, but that in digging a new subway line, they discovered some remains of some of the early Washington politicians. Personally, I think this is a newer version of some STD diagnostic procedure that I'm not quite aware of that Matt can share with me. So welcome to my world. What I'm going to talk about today mostly are policies and policy changes that have been catalyzed by the Affordable Care Act and some of the new challenges, strategies, and opportunities that that represents for the clinical sector and how, at the end, that may relate to publicly funded STD clinics and ask the question, is this the end? So we clearly have the greatest acute care system in the world. People come from all over the world to be treated, but 46 million Americans lack coverage. We have an uncoordinated system of care that's fragmented delivery systems with tremendous opportunity to improve quality and improve outcomes. It's unsupportive of patients and it's unsupportive of providers. Just go out into the community and ask any primary care doc, would you have your kids go to medical school today? And there's just a lot of anger and a lot of resentment and a lot of pain out there. And it's unsustainable. Costs are rising at twice the inflation rate, and it's unsustainable for the federal budget, and it's unsustainable for state budgets, and it's unsustainable for beneficiaries. The average Social Security check, about a third of that relates for Medicare recipients to co-pays and premiums, one-third of their Social Security check. And a tremendous number of people live on that Social Security check. So from a budgetary point of view and a beneficiary point of view, this can't be sustained. Don Berwick gave us three aims, a vision for what the healthcare system would be like in the future. Better care, improved individual patient experiences of care along the six domains of the IOM definition of quality: safety, effectiveness, patient-centeredness, timeliness, efficiency, and equity. Better health, focusing on the underlying health outcomes and the root causes of poor health, and this is what you do, so I don't need to explain that. And reduced costs, lowering the cost of care resulting in reduced expenditures on the part of federal and state governments, and the challenge is lowering the cost without harming individuals and without denying necessary care for people. That's the three-part aim. So Neil Halfon has a conceptual model that is really resonating with those of us in CMS that are thinking through the population health. And this is sort of a conceptual model of the transformation of the delivery system. We are currently in healthcare 1.0. We have a good acute system of care, but it's episodic, It's not integrated. It lacks quality and cost performance, and it lacks transparency, and we are poorly coordinated around chronic care, and I would say other areas like HIV and STD. What we're trying to get to is healthcare 2.0. An outcomes accountable care system that is patient-centered and family-centered. It is transparent. It delivers on cost and quality performance. There is accountability, that there is shared financial risk between the payers, and in this case, the public payers, the taxpayers, and the providers, that health information technology is integrated, and that involves health information exchange, the use of decision tools, and whatnot, and it focuses on prevention and management of care. But this is transitionary. Where we really want to be is healthcare 3.0, which is integrating community care and clinical care. It is focused on healthy populations, not only those patients in front of us. It is focused on population health and public health strategies. It involves integrated networks linked to community resources and capable of addressing not only clinical issues but root causes, underlying psychosocial issues, and economic needs of individuals within that community. That there is a population-based reimbursement, not simply a fee for a service, not simply a volume-based driven, but an outcomes-based driven payment mechanism, and in which healthcare providers are learning organizations capable of rapid evaluation and deployment of best practices, that community health resources are integrated, and that truly health information technology is a fundamental infrastructure piece. So let's look at the three-part aim, healthcare, and costs. We have a lot going on with regards to the Affordable Care Act and better health. We have first dollar coverage for prevention, not only in Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP, but also through the exchanges in the private system. We have true health system transformation. We have a lot going on, and that's the bulk of my talk, around population-based strategies that we are inducing and funding our providers to enter into. And then we have a lot of population health initiatives that are collaborations between CDC, CMS, between public health and clinical care, the Million Hearts Campaign, work on diabetes and tobacco. And then we clearly have the Prevention and Public Health Trust Fund. But it was very sobering to see that the first thing that Congress cut to pay for the doc fix was the Prevention and Public Health Fund. So that is writing on the wall in terms of who's going to be thrown under the bus first. It's going to be you. Always has been. So the other interesting feature of the Affordable Care Act is that hospitals have a new role in population health. There are new requirements under the Affordable Care Act on tax-exempt hospitals. To retain their tax-exempt status, they must do a community health needs assessment that is driven by public health and by public health professionals, that is linked to the community. And they must program their funds to address those top community health needs, or they're going to have an excise tax and they're going to lose their state tax-exempt status. Huge issue that I think is really a very positive thing. Let's look at costs. So the economists tell us that fully one-third of the costs that we pay are wasteful and unnecessary. So that ranges from between about 40% and 20%, but a third of the costs are unnecessary. And by that, economists mean these are procedures and expenditures which do not improve the health of the beneficiary at all. And so if you think about it, in a system of healthcare that is $2.5 trillion a year, if a third of those costs are unnecessary, and if we can capture just a portion of those unnecessary costs and invest them and redirect them into processes that do improve health, we have enough money in the system. So this is a general sense of where people think those costs come from. I'm not getting into that, but this is the operating theory behind where we need to go. And you're going to hear that a decade ago when I was last at this conference and gave a talk. I said the dominant conversation in Washington is about cost and access. Well, the dominant conversation is now about cost. People feel that they've really got access under control with the Affordable Care Act, and it's cost, cost, and cost. So how is the healthcare system and how is CMS and HHS driving better care and lower costs? It's being driven through payment reform and delivery system reform, through payment policies, through regulations, demonstration programs. We're spending $10 billion, $1 billion a year over the next 10 years in the Innovation Center to test and rapidly deploy and scale up these innovations, many of which are population health interventions. And there are similar and parallel things going on in the private sector. You just look to new product lines that managed care companies are giving and new demonstrations, and 12 states have passed laws that enable and facilitate accountable care organizations. So there's just a lot going on both in the public and in the private sector. And I'd like to highlight just a couple of those interventions that I think are relevant for today's discussion. First of all, it's accountable care organizations. What is an accountable care organization? It is a group of healthcare providers, usually doctors, hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, other providers, that establish a mechanism for shared governance, agree to be held accountable for quality and cost and overall care for beneficiaries. They agree to invest in an infrastructure to redesign care processes, to communicate and coordinate, and if they do so, and if they're held accountable for quality metrics, if they're able to save money, increase efficiency, and deliver on quality, they get to share in what they save. Let me go back for a second. There are many flavors of accountable care organizations. There are safety net accountable care organizations. There are advanced ones for the pioneers, those integrated systems that are already doing a really good job and are already in population health. And then there's the beginner models in which we invest up front and give them an advance on their savings, so that there's lots of different flavors of this. But this is one of the key signature programs within the Affordable Care Act for transforming care, and a tremendous opportunity to bring population health into clinical medicine. The other is an emphasis on primary care and medical homes. A medical home delivery model centers around a primary care physician. It is standard fee-for-service volume-based payment, but it adds a monthly care management fee and potentially an enhanced pay-for-performance as well. And the idea is if you get multiple payers, Medicare, Medicaid, managed care, health plans, all taking care of their patients in a similar arrangement, then for the provider, they get enhanced reimbursement. They get to invest in practice transformation. Now, they have accountabilities. They have to be accountable for delivering on the capacities of a transformed practice through NCQA certification. They have to demonstrate access, continuity of care, and investment in health information technology. They have to plan for chronic care and preventive care, and they have to engage and empower patients and their families, and they are, again, held accountable for cost and quality. So other types of regulations and payment policies, it's all around changing payment from a fee-for-service to a value-based proposition. And so we have a number of different programs for hospitals and physicians in which we incentivize through penalty for those hospitals that don't report and publish their data. We have an additional quality withhold of 2% of their entire book of business in 2017 that will redistribute to top performing institutions and take away then from the bottom performing institutions. We're further cutting if they don't do hospital, if they have high hospital readmission rates. We're further cutting if they're in the top quartile of hospital acquired, preventable hospital acquired conditions. And we're beginning to do the same thing with physicians in terms of publishing their quality metrics. And beginning in 2015, every physician will have a value-based payment modifier based on quality and efficiency, and they will be paid more if they deliver better quality at a lower cost, and they will be paid less if they don't. And this is hugely transformative. We have incentive programs for electronic health records, which include incentives and penalties, carrots and sticks. So again, without boring you with a litany of all of the majestic range of programs within the Affordable Care Act that I think will really transform the system, let me share a little bit about the policy environment that STD clinics and providers are in. We have a budget deficit and a poor economy that will continue to be flat, and there will continue to be decreasing resources and increasing calls to take that 30% of unnecessary spending and waste out of the system. In 2014, through the Affordable Care Act, there will be an influx of new, previously uninsured patients with unmet needs. We clearly have changing demographics. For Medicare, that's going to be a huge challenge, as 48 million beneficiaries now swell to 78 million beneficiaries when the last boomer retires. But for STD clinics, what is the change in demographics for you and the demand for your services, as we know that Medicare beneficiary population is probably not going to be your target population? We have underlying causes of poor health, and those are worsening in the worsening economy. We have clear health disparities that are worsening, and we have a toxic political environment in which a single Medicare benefit for advanced care planning gets demagogued into death panels. And in that type of environment, I'm not seeing any bipartisan approach to solving some of these very challenging issues. So what are the emerging trends? A greater emphasis on population health that is going to absolutely be required of all institutions in order to do well. A greater emphasis on primary care, making primary care what it should be, and rationalizing the use of costly specialists. A greater emphasis on consumer engagement and empowerment, performance measures so that providers will be absolutely held accountable on cost and quality measures, and payment will be linked to it, and those that do poorly are going to suffer. And ironically, those that do poorly may be those that that are serving African-American communities, serving rural communities in need, so we have to figure that piece out. But we absolutely, providers are going to figure out how to spend less and get better outcomes, or they're not going to get paid as much. We have an emphasis on coordination of care across multiple organizations and multiple body systems to take care of the whole patient. And we have an increasing consolidation, mergers, and acquisitions to get larger systems of care that can invest in the infrastructure to do all this stuff. So what the new challenges that hospitals and doctors and care providers have are, number one, surviving on lower payments. It's not going to get better. Number two is decreasing utilization, figuring out a way to get out of that conundrum of more cost and more reimbursement for more widgets, and figuring out how to deliver health rather than how to deliver healthcare services. Eliminating unnecessary costs, and by the way, how do we overcome the transition cost to invest in all of this stuff to get from point A to point B when the payment infrastructure hasn't transformed yet? So in order to cope, providers, hospitals, doctors are going to become better providers of population-based services. They need to look for best practices, to reduce variation, to learn from a variety of programs and people's and organizations that are doing it and doing it well. And they have to redesign care with a laser focus to decrease resource consumption, eliminate redundancy, streamline care processes, and prioritize those coordination and those processes that deliver health outcomes. They need to embrace health information technology, and most of all, you can't do it by staying within your own walls. In order to do this, hospitals have to get out into the community. They have to leave their building, and they're beginning to do so, and think about the health of the community. Other providers need to figure out who they need to collaborate with, who they need to coordinate with, and even health plans are struggling. And the managed care plans of the 1980s and 1990s are now thinking, how can they forge new relationships with providers, not be adversarial, not impose restrictions externally, but how do they become the back engines of data and management and coordination, because they have that expertise. And that's an opportunity to be on the same side as opposed to being adversarial. And I think the patient wins and the payer wins. And lastly, I think this is a call for everybody to focus on their core mission. I think hospitals and doctors and even public health sometimes has lost its way. Why are we in this business in the first place? And so with that, let me just take a couple of minutes to really talk about STD clinics and to bring this back to why you're all here. You are subject to the same environmental trends and the same challenges that doctors and hospitals in the clinical world are. And that means public health absolutely has to prioritize. What is the unique niche for government public health? Is it clinical care, or is it other population-based strategies? And I think you need to be thinking about what is the unique role that STD control has in a government situation. In an era of decreasing resources. So is maintaining a network of publicly funded, publicly operated, single organ clinical systems a wise investment of public resources, or is it a model of care whose time has passed? So the need is still there. I mean, we know that primary care is primary prevention. And unlike many other things, there is a powerful clinical rationale to early diagnose and treat partners. So I'm not denying that. I'm asking the question, is there still a need, since there still is a need for clinical STD services, where is it best delivered and how is it best delivered in a changing healthcare environment? With an increasing emphasis on primary care, what are the organizational capacities that an STD clinic has versus a transformed medical home around improved access to services, around the assurance of quality of care at the lowest cost, and be thinking not only about the clinical care, but about how the population services get integrated into that. What is the best organization to do that? With an increasing emphasis on primary care, is it time to reconnect the genitals to the rest of the body? We in clinical care don't do a very good job above the neck and below the belt in terms of mental health and oral health and sexual health in terms of making that health. And is increasing or maintaining those artificial silos the best way to look forward at true health? So in a transformed practice or a safety net medical home that targets communities in which you care about, the expectation is that they will treat the whole person, they will be culturally competent, that they will have access to care, that access to care may include transportation, may include enhanced hours, that they will have psychosocial wraparound services, such as transportation and home visits and the mental health and addiction services that go along with their issues, that those practices will invest in a quality improvement in a system, and that they will invest in health information technology, and they will be accountable for three-part AIM outcomes by the payers. So in this environment, can STD clinics that are county-funded compete? Lastly, I'd like to suggest that it's not about should we de-emphasize STD clinics, because the funding reality is such that in all but a handful of geographies, it is not a question of should, but when and how. because we don't have the luxury and you don't have the luxury of making that decision. Those decisions are being made externally and they're being made on the basis of other priorities, most of which are funding. And so in that environment, how do you survive? Again, like the clinicians and the hospitals, it's about new partners, new skills, and new roles. One of the things that I like to do when I hang out in a hotel is read the papers that I don't get a chance to read. And so this morning, there were two fascinating front page articles on the local paper. And so the local paper here is the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Above the fold, legislators lose taste for wellness campaign. Now, I happen to know, because of my work with the Innovation Center, that Minneapolis and Minnesota has one of the top 10 population health demonstration programs in the country. It's been cited by the Prevention Institute as a national model. An ambitious program intended to help Minnesotans slim down, eat nutritious food, and ditch unhealthy habits is losing momentum and financial support, and officials caution that their goal of saving nearly $1.9 billion in future health care costs is slipping out of reach. Now, in the wake of its funding being slashed by more than two-thirds last year, the program faces an uncertain future. This is a national model, one of the top 10 programs. I don't believe and have not seen any evidence that the money being spent has any measurable effect on anything, says State Senator blah, blah, blah. Okay. This is today's version, below the fold, front page of the USA Today, something I only read in hotels, closing the books at Britannica. After 244 years and more than 7 million printed sets, the company is announcing today that it will no longer publish a print edition. The last 32-volume print version published in 2010 weighs 129 pounds and sells for $1,395. Okay, this was first published in Scotland in 1768. This is interesting. Caused a stir. King George III ordered pages about midwifery, which depicted illustrations of fetuses and female pelvises, to be turned out and torn out. So even back then, reproductive health was a pariah. But Britannica closed, stopped ending door-to-door sales, and they became the first online encyclopedia published on the internet. So the question is, which one are you? Are you the Minnesota program that is clearly a national model, or are you the Britannica that has figured out how to adapt? So I would say it's not the end of STD control, but maybe it should be the end of STD clinics. Thank you.